When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
You ever get the feeling the city walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating your soul? You crave wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe chase some elk, fish a private stream. Well, listen up. There's a whole world out there, and finding your own piece of it just got easier. Head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forest, mountains, you name it. Search by acreage, location, the kind of hunting or fishing you dream of. Land.com. It's where the adventure begins.
Live from Television City in Hollywood.
On the evening of October 13th, 1957, millions of Americans sat down to watch a special event on television featuring some of the country's most popular entertainers.
Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, Rosemary Clooney, Louis Armstrong.
But the real star of the show?
This is the Ed Zone! This is the Ed Zone! This is the Ed Zone Show!
Yes, the Edsel, the car that the Ford Motor Company, sponsors of this show, was introducing to the public with unprecedented fanfare. Here's Bing Crosby with old blue eyes, Frank Sinatra.
This is an opening show, you know, on TV for Edsel to go all the way.
It's a great car, too, Bing, and they're putting on a great splurge.
It was a big night.
When the Edsel first came out, this was a big deal, right?
It was about as big a deal as you could imagine.
But not too big to fail. Just 2 years after its launch, the Edsel was out of gas, the very name immortalized as a byword for failure. But Edsel wasn't just the name of a car.
Edsel was the name of Henry Ford's only son.
And one of history's most famous Nepo babies. Yes, Nepo baby. The Nepo is short for nepotism. You may have heard the term Nepo baby to describe celebrity children born to celebrity parents, and all the advantages that come with that. But family connections affect every field of work, and always have. And when family is involved, so is drama. In this episode, we'll tell you the story of Henry and Edsel Ford.
Oh, the pressure of being the son of that guy.
It had to be tough knowing that you would never be able to top what your father had done because it couldn't be done anymore.
You'll also hear about the first father and son to make it to the White House.
Service is the family business.
Service is the family business because the family business is America.
And speaking of the White House, we'll recount the tale of the famous daughter who strolled into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue on four legs.
Was Pushinka a Nepo baby?
I would have to say yes. I mean, look at the lineage she came from.
Three stories, three families, three big names. Well, two if you don't count the dog. From CBS Sunday Morning and iHeart, I'm Mo Rocca, and this is Mobituaries. This Mobit, Nepo Babies of History. Edsel Ford, John Quincy Adams, and Pushinka the Dog. You say the word
Edsel, and most people think what?
A synonym for failure or commercial product failure in any event.
That's Matt Anderson. He's the curator of transportation at the amazing Henry Ford Museum of American Innovation in Dearborn, Michigan. For 10 seasons, I've hosted the CBS television series Innovation Nation at the Henry Ford. And Matt is my go-to guy for all things automotive.
I like to think that the Edsel was overstyled, oversold, and overpriced.
Would you say it was a bad car?
I don't think the Edsel was a bad car per se. I mean, it was a solid vehicle. The engineering did work, but it just wasn't what the market wanted. You know, Ford promised something entirely new in automotive engineering and design, and in the end, the Edsel just had things that were kind of gimmicky.
The Edsel was meant to compete with mid-priced cars like Chrysler's Dodge and GM's Pontiac and Buick, and it boasted several genuine innovations, like system warning lights on the dashboard, which every car made today has. But it also had features no one seemed to need, like a rolling dome speedometer. And debuting in the midst of a recession, its low miles per gallon was a non-starter for most consumers. As for the design of the car, it got attention all right. The wrong kind of attention. The oddly shaped vertical grille at the front. Comedian Danny Thomas said it made the car look like an Oldsmobile sucking a lemon. Others likened the grille's shape to something more risque.
That was a comment made at the time and made ever since. Yes, that the Edsel represented a certain anatomical part. We'll leave it at that.
The company had spent 10 years and $250 million on the Edsel. After just three model years and a loss of $350 million, the Edsel was discontinued. Over 16 years after the man for whom it was named, someone who had nothing to do with the car, had died. The final insult to a man who never got the credit he deserved, from the public or from his own father.
When folks generations into the future think back on the 20th century, there are just a few names that are going to be remembered, and Henry Ford's is one of them.
Henry Ford revolutionized mass industrial production with the assembly line. He introduced the $5 workday, helping to create a middle class. And he was the man behind the vehicle that changed America.
The Model T, which Henry Ford had designed and introduced, changed the automobile from being a plaything for the wealthy into a tool of everyday life.
It ended the isolation of the farmer and made the Sunday ride a national institution.
When Edsel Ford rolled off the assembly line on November 16, 1893, courtesy of Henry and Clara Ford, the family wasn't yet wealthy. Henry was still just getting started.
Just about 6 weeks after Edsel was born, he built his first internal combustion engine, and it worked. He only ran it for about 30 seconds or so, but that moment kind of was a eureka moment for Henry Ford. He knew that this was what he was going to do. He was going to get into the automobile business.
An only child, Edsel grew up alongside that business. At age two, he rode in his father's first gas-powered automobile, the quadricycle. P.S. I've driven in a replica of the original. Four big bicycle wheels, a little buggy seat, and no brakes. You had to use your foot to stop it, Fred Flintstone style. As a young boy, Edsel spent hours drawing imaginative designs for his own cars. As a teenager, he spent as much time as he could after school at his father's auto plant, helping with the mail, attaching brass tags to new vehicles. And in 1908, when Edsel was 16 years old, Henry unveiled the Model T.
I think it's a measure of the esteem in which his father held him at that point that Edsel was a part of a very small group who was involved in designing the Ford Model T. Henry literally built a kind of a secret room in the corner of the factory where his top engineers would sit and work through what this automobile should be. And Edsel was there for all of those discussions.
As soon as he graduated from high school, Edsel went to work for his father full time. A newspaper at the time described him as, quote, a quiet, hardworking youngster with a desk in his father's office, as familiar with every branch of the business as any of the officers in the company.
He was elected to the board of directors in 1915 when he was all of 22 years old. So he moves pretty quickly from the bottom up to the upper reaches of Ford Motor Company.
Do you think that he worried that people thought he was there only because he was the boss's son?
That had to nag at the back of Edsel's conscience, that people somewhere up or down the line at Ford Motor Company would have thought he was just there by virtue of who his father was.
When Edsel asked for an exemption from military service during World War I to keep working at Ford Motor Company, he was accused of being a draft dodger.
I think that haunted him because he really did believe that he was of more value working at Ford Motor Company than overseas.
But Edsel, who was named president of the company at age 25, would prove himself worthy of his position, and in many ways, a stark contrast to his father.
They were very much different. In fact, about as polar opposite as you could imagine. Henry grew up on a farm. He never finished his grade school education and kind of worked his way up to his ultimate career goals.
Here's Henry espousing his belief that success starts and ends with hard work.
A young man makes up his mind to work, there's no limit to what he can do. If he makes up his mind to go at it without the idea of work, he hasn't much chance. He must study and work.
Henry was proudly unpolished. On the other hand, Edsel was urbane and sophisticated. Henry didn't trust experts. Edsel admired them. Henry had little interest in the arts. Edsel was a great patron of music and art in Detroit. He commissioned the monumental Detroit Industry Murals from Mexican artist Diego Rivera for the Detroit Institute of Arts. And let me tell you, if you are ever in the Motor City, you must go see them. Henry never drank and kept a close circle of friends. Edsel loved to socialize.
You know, people talk about work-life balance today. Did they differ on that score?
Absolutely. Henry lived and breathed his work. Even when he was at home, he was still thinking about what was going on at the Ford Motor Company.
Whereas Edsel?
He would put in his 40 hours, his 50 hours, whatever it took at the company. But when he went home, that was his time to enjoy with his family, to enjoy recreational pursuits, to enjoy education, enrichment, whatever it might be.
Edsel married Eleanor Clay in 1916. They wasted no time in starting a family. Their first child, Henry Ford II, was born in 1917. They went on to have three more. Now, in terms of whom you'd rather have as a boss?
Henry had a very gruff management style, his way or the highway. Edsel preferred to let people talk about different options and think it over and come to a logical conclusion.
Edsel was just a lot friendlier.
And Edsel made a point of greeting everybody on the way into work in the morning from the people on the ground level there right on up to the senior executives. And Henry always had a kind of a colder look about him, particularly as he got older, you know, almost a scowl about him, which would make him a little scary.
And not to be rude, but from certain angles, he could look like Mr. Burns from The Simpsons.
That's an adequate comparison, I think, there.
I wonder if Henry was jealous of his son when he saw how much employees liked Edsel.
I would imagine to some extent, too, Henry was probably jealous just of Edsel's youth. It's inevitable as we get older. And here's Edsel rising up and just hitting the peak and the prime of his own life. And it's a time that's passed for Henry. So that had to have been a part of it, too.
Did Henry ever try to undermine his son?
Unfortunately, Henry undermined his son at just about every turn.
Edsel may have been the company's president, but Henry never actually gave up the wheel. He retained full authority. Case in point, when the Highland Park plant was becoming overcrowded, senior managers appealed to Edsel.
So after listening to this and seeing the evidence, Edsel said, let's build an annex, a new building for our administrative offices. And they'd gotten to the point where they dug a hole for the foundation.
But when Henry saw the hole, he didn't like it. He put the kibosh on Edsel's expansion plans.
And Edsel tried to reason with his father, push back against this idea. Henry wouldn't hear it. And Edsel finally just says, okay, fine. We'll close everything down. We'll fill in the hole. You'd think that would be the end of it, but it wasn't. Henry said, no, don't fill in the hole. Leave it that way. And so for several months afterward, everyone who came into Ford Motor Company saw this big gaping hole in the ground. They were, in effect, reminded every morning of who had the final say at Ford Motor Company. So absolutely humiliating.
And to do that to his own son.
Yeah, very, very cruel.
Driving father and son farther apart were their differing views on the world. Henry was viciously and very publicly anti-Semitic.
That is the darkest stain on Henry Ford's character, and one that has not gone away and won't and shouldn't. He was a virulent anti-Semite.
In 1918, Henry purchased the Dearborn Independent newspaper, which a year and a half later, under his direction, began publishing a series of articles entitled The International Jew, The World's Problem, which claimed there was a vast Jewish conspiracy and blamed the Jewish people for everything from war to jazz music. The newspaper was distributed at dealerships across the country, reaching a circulation of 900,000.
And Edsel and Clara, too, to their credit, they were on the board of directors, quote unquote, of the Dearborn Independent because it was owned entirely by the Ford family. They resigned. Edsel in particular said, no, I'm not going to have anything to do with this newspaper. He knew he couldn't stop his father from publishing it, but at least he wasn't going to be a part of it.
And then in the mid-1920s came a rift over Henry's other child, his beloved Model T.
The car was absolutely cutting edge in 1908, 1909 when it was built and introduced. But by the mid-20s, it's a dinosaur.
The Chevrolet was helping General Motors roar past Ford, but Henry didn't want to hear it.
That slump in the Model T sales, which really fall off a cliff starting about 1925, is where the break between Henry and Edsel really begins, where their more or less friendly and familial relationship starts to fall apart.
After years of pleading, Edsel finally convinced Henry to trade in the Model T for the bigger and better-looking Model A.
The Model A is no doubt the first Ford automobile that had real style to it, real class.
Boy, it seems like the cars that each of them championed were sort of a reflection of them temperamentally, right? The Model T, so important, ultimately very practical. The Model A, nicer to look at, more comfortable to drive.
Yeah.
With its design supervised by Edsel, the Model A went on to sell over 4.5 million and put Ford back on top. Henry took the credit, but it was Edsel's triumph, and not his only one. Edsel was the driving force behind Ford's first luxury vehicle, the Lincoln Continental, which architect Frank Lloyd Wright called the most beautiful car in the world.
To this day, critics, enthusiasts alike will refer to it as one of the most beautiful American production cars ever built.
The United States, even when it is running in low, is a pretty big business proposition.
You are now hearing rare audio of the press-shy Edsel Ford appearing alongside his father in 1935.
But I believe the country is getting ready to make a very decided step forward next year, and we are doing all that we can to help it along. What do you think of that, Father?
Well, I think everybody's decided that they've got to go to work.
By that point, Ford Motor Company, under Edsel, was playing a major role in aviation.
People might not realize Ford Motor Company was very busy in the aviation business in the 1920s into the very early 1930s. They built 199 Ford trimotor airplanes, which were really the first successful all-metal commercial aircraft flown in the United States.
When America entered World War II, Edsel oversaw production of one bomber per hour at the company's Willow Run plant.
It was Edsel that was there running the company, meeting with the government, meeting with the military, making things happen. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that Edsel kind of gave his dying breath toward World War II production of Ford Motor Company. I mean, he gave his every last ounce to that effort.
It was during the war, in 1943, that Edsel began experiencing intense pain in his stomach. His physician diagnosed him with ulcers. When the pain didn't subside, Edsel visited specialists who discovered that he was suffering from stomach cancer.
Sadly, at that point, it had spread to other organs, and you have to wonder if they had not misdiagnosed it as ulcers. You know, even in the early 40s, stomach cancer wasn't necessarily fatal.
But even as he weakened, Edsel continued working at the office. Does he tell his father?
Edsel tells his father about his condition. Unfortunately, Henry sort of dismissed the whole thing. He said, well, no, Edsel's just feeling sick because he's partying too much. He's drinking too much. He's not eating the right foods. And Henry was a fanatic on diet. I think Henry refused to accept that his son could be terminally ill because this was the person who was going to keep Ford Motor Company going.
Eventually, Edsel was confined to his home in Grosse Pointe. Henry and Clara visited their son's bedside. But even in Edsel's final weeks of life, Henry was ignoring reality, insisting to associates that Edsel would be back at work in just a few weeks. Edsel Bryant Ford died on May 29, 1943. The obituary from the New York Times read, "In the untimely death of Edsel Ford at age 49, the nation has suffered a serious loss. Self-effacing and instinctively avoiding the limelight, he had been for more than two decades, in every sense, a full partner of his father."
There's a great story about some of the Ford production managers coming in to work the day after Edsel passed away and seeing the flag and half staff, and they just parked the car and kind of burst into tears because they all knew what that meant and who they had lost. So, you know, people really did admire Edsel. And you know, his whole life, Henry had just been trying to turn Edsel into something that he wasn't. He wanted his son to be more like himself, the same personality, the same kind of cutthroat instincts. And that just wasn't going to happen.
After Edsel's death, Henry's own health went into rapid decline. He suffered a series of small strokes and a brain hemorrhage, and 4 years later died at his home in Dearborn on April 7, 1947. A decade later, the Ford Motor Company debuted its Edsel line. How should Edsel Ford be remembered?
Edsel Ford should not be remembered for the Edsel automobile, and that's one of the great ironies in American automotive history. People hear that name, they think about that failed car, and of course, not only did he have nothing to do with it, it really is the antithesis of what he stood for. He should be remembered for his successes, certainly aviation for the Lincoln Continental, and he should also be remembered for his work during World War II. So there's no question that he served his country in the highest and best sense.
Coming up, the Adams family. A Nepo baby seeks to redeem his father at the ballot box.
I think he realized that he would have to carry on the family's name, but also make it his own.
Circling Back Podcast here. Hey, Dylan, been looking for a nicotine pouch that goes hard and lasts long.
Then let's talk about Lucy, Dave, the Lucy Breaker.
Oh, yeah.
The Lucy Breaker is 100% pure nicotine, always tobacco-free. It comes in 4 or 8 milligrams. It's got a flavor capsule inside. You bite down on it. It is so good and gets you dialed in.
Tell me about these flavors.
All right, we got mango. We got mint. My favorite is actually apple ice.
Ooh, okay. Could I interest you in some espresso?
I'll try the espresso, sure. I haven't had that one yet.
I like that.
If you want to try Lucy, go to lucy.co/trylucy and use promo code TRYLUCY to get 20% off your first order. Lucy products are only for adults of legal age, and every customer is age verified. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. at retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, for product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
Imagine a Mount Rushmore of Nepo babies. We would probably include Edsel Ford. We'd also have to save a spot for Jesus, since, after all, he's the Son of God. I'd give the third spot to Liza Minnelli. She's the daughter of Judy Garland and director Vincent Minnelli, so she had a leg up in Hollywood from birth, but she earned that Oscar for Cabaret. As for that fourth slot, well, considering that the actual Mount Rushmore is for presidents, I'm giving it to our sixth president, who was also the son of our second president. I'm talking about John Quincy Adams, and yes, it's Quincy, not Quincy. Now, Edsel Ford's father helped invent the modern age. That's daunting. But John Quincy Adams's dad helped invent a country, the United States.
When your father is not just your father, but is a founding father, that's got to be a lot of pressure.
It's a tremendous amount of pressure, and it's not just any of the founders. It's John and Abigail Adams.
Alexis Coe is a presidential historian. She calls John and Abigail the original helicopter parents. And yes, I realize helicopters didn't exist in the colonial era, but you get the picture.
They were involved in every aspect of their children's lives.
They were all up in it, right?
There was a really long to-do list. It's exhausting.
Just one item on that list? Translating the works of Greek historian Thucydides. Mind you, Quincy was just 10 years old at the time.
And from a young age, he showed promise. It wasn't just that he was the eldest son. It's that he was exceptional.
The second of six, Quincy was born July 11th, 1767, in Braintree, Massachusetts.
He is funny, he is pithy, but he's so serious and like his parents and more like his father. He's always stressed out.
Well, of course, this is not a normal child rearing. Aside from being the son of a founding father, there's a revolution going on, yeah?
Literally outside their home. They're seeing soldiers march by. They are aware that they are a prominent family in what the British are calling a rebellion. They're not calling it a revolution.
If this rebellion fails, his father could be executed, right?
Very likely. It is a treasonous act.
During the height of the Revolutionary War, the young boy traveled with his father on missions to Europe on behalf of the fledgling Republic. Crossing the ocean wasn't exactly smooth sailing. First, their ship was struck by lightning, and then they traded fire with and captured an enemy vessel. At the ripe old age of 14, Quincy was sent off without his father to Russia, where he served as secretary to the American diplomat Francis Dana. The CBS News archives don't go back that far, but here's the dramatized version, courtesy of the HBO John Adams miniseries, with the excellent Paul Giamatti in the title role.
You must not let the idea of going to Russia frighten you. You're 14 years old, Johnny. Already a man, and never one for childish pursuits. Yes? And I have confidence that you will make both of us very proud.
I would rather stay here with you, Father.
Funny, when I was 14, my father was sending me off to the drugstore with quarters to play Ms. Pac-Man. Now, even as a kid, Quincy documented it all, but his diaries had pictures.
He's a doodler, so we have all these great journals in which he's drawing ships and people, and he's writing not only for himself and for the letters he has to write home, but also because he's really aware that they are significant in history, if they make it.
I love, though, that he's doodling because it's a reminder that he's just a kid. He's 14, so he's doodling in the 18th century equivalent of a trapper keeper, basically, right?
Absolutely.
And while there were no pop stars around back then, Quincy definitely had an American idol.
He was nothing short of a fanboy for George Washington. when he was abroad on his own and he was living at The Hague, he put up what is basically the equivalent of a poster of George Washington.
And George Washington was impressed by young Quincy, as were many of the founding fathers.
They all believed that he had incredible potential to continue their legacy without, however, nepotism, because, of course, we were not a monarchy.
Now, most of the children of the founding fathers could only land jobs through their connections. By and large, they were a pretty mediocre bunch, including Quincy's own siblings. His brother Charles was described by their father, John Adams, as, quote, a madman possessed of the devil. At 15, Charles was caught streaking across Harvard Yard. By age 30, he'd abandoned his law practice and his family. Brother Thomas was described as a bully and a brute and was equally unsuccessful. Their sister Nabby married a man Abigail Adams deemed wholly devoid of judgment. His shady business dealings consigned Nabby to a life of financial insecurity. Quincy, on the other hand, sought only to please John and Abigail. "The first and deepest of all my wishes," he wrote, "is to give satisfaction to my parents." He graduated with highest honors from Harvard, where by all accounts he kept his clothes on in public, before embarking on a brilliant career in diplomacy, serving every president from Washington through Monroe. Quincy helped negotiate the Treaty of Ghent, ending the War of 1812. And as President Monroe's Secretary of State, he formulated the policy barring European involvement in the Americas, also known as the Monroe Doctrine. Now, early in his diplomatic career, his father served as the nation's first vice president. Then, in 1796, John Adams was elected the nation's second president. Shortly after his father's inauguration, Quincy married the British Louisa Catherine Adams. She would become our first foreign-born first lady. They would have four children. Of course, there was some family drama of their own when they named their eldest after none other than George Washington.
Which was not totally unheard of, but it's certainly significant to name your child George Washington when your father was also kind of a big deal.
Let me ask, did that hurt his parents' feelings?
Here's what's interesting is John Adams would complain about the smallest of things for pages upon pages. And he would not only do it in one letter, he'd repeat it in 9 different letters. But sometimes he left this kind of personal business, shall we say, to Abigail. And Abigail wrote to Quincy's brother that when Quincy named his child George Washington, that it hurt his father's feelings.
It seems that Quincy got the memo. He named his second son, John. George Washington Adams was born just a few months after his grandfather was voted out of the White House. John Adams was the first president to lose a bid for re-election and serve only one term, a tough pill to swallow for the whole Adams family. How did this affect John Quincy Adams?
I think he realized that he would have to carry on the family's name, but also make it his own.
And so Quincy decided to run for president in 1824. According to biographer Paul C. Nagle, one of Quincy's motives was to, quote, emulate or surpass his revered father's distinguished career and thereby burnish the Adams family name. After a nasty 4-way race that included Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams was elected our 6th president. When he notified his father, the aging and normally reserved former president responded movingly, "Never did I feel so much solemnity as upon this occasion. The multitude of my thoughts and the intensity of my feelings are too much for a mind like mine in its 90th year."
It's the first American dynasty. It's significant. He's proud, but he's also got to then sort of instill certain boundaries with his father, with other people. And he's well aware that he needs to be his own president.
John Quincy Adams became the first non-founding father to hold the nation's highest office. But he'd seen all his predecessors in action up close.
This is where being a Nepo baby, I think, is probably useful for everyone, because he kind of knew all these guys growing up.
he did, and he took notes. He understood it was a great privilege.
Alas, much like his father's time in office, Quincy struggled. He'd come into the office without a popular majority. And throughout his term, he faced opposition on everything from his support for education to his proposal for a national observatory. His happiest time as president? Kneeling in the White House garden, growing vegetables. It was during his term that his father died, on July 4, 1826, the very same day Thomas Jefferson died, the 50th anniversary of the country's founding. Yes, that sound you're hearing is thunder. In the following presidential election, a dispirited Quincy was trounced by Andrew Jackson. He returned to Massachusetts, an unsuccessful one-termer, the only one-term president since his father.
I think he almost always felt like he was on the precipice of failure. To have it realized was probably the worst thing that ever happened to him.
And then months later, a terrible personal loss. His son, George Washington Adams, died by suicide, by throwing himself from a ferry into the Long Island Sound. Quincy, like John Adams before him, was a demanding father, and it may have been an imminent confrontation with the old man that pushed George over the edge. At this point, John Quincy Adams could have retired to a quiet life.
He would have felt as if he was wasting his potential, because these are people who believe in service.
Service is the family business.
Service is the family business because the family business is America.
John Quincy Adams did not retreat into private life. Instead, after much encouragement, he decided to run for a seat in the House of Representatives from his home state of Massachusetts, and he won in a landslide. But wasn't this a step down from the presidency?
Absolutely not. It's doing real work, meaning legislation, representing people, not just this performance of being the president and hosting and all those things, which nobody really likes. You're actually doing work, and I think he loved it.
At age 64, service in Congress meant a chance at redemption for himself and the Adams family. And in this final act, Quincy found a new passion in the fight against slavery. It's important to note, of the first 12 presidents, John Adams and John Quincy Adams were the only two not to own slaves.
This is the most important case ever come before this court. Because what it in fact concerns is the very nature of man.
That's Anthony Hopkins as John Quincy Adams in the 1997 Steven Spielberg film Amistad. In 1839, 53 enslaved Africans managed to take control of their captor's ship, the schooner Amistad, before the ship itself was taken into custody off the coast of Connecticut. The fate of the Africans, whether they'd be allowed to return to Africa, divided the nation. The case made its way to the Supreme Court, and the now 72-year-old Quincy, who had earned the nickname Old Man Eloquent, argued the case on behalf of the Africans. Here's Hopkins as Quincy addressing the court.
We desperately need your strength and wisdom to triumph over our fears, our prejudices, ourselves. Give us the courage to do what is right. And if it means civil war, then let it come. And when it does, may it be finally the last battle of the American Revolution.
Quincy's stature as a former president and the son of a founding father meant he could not be easily dismissed. Invoking the Declaration of Independence, he called for the Africans' inalienable rights of life and liberty to be restored. The court agreed and ruled for the Africans. It was a great triumph for Quincy, perhaps the most significant of his long, long career. 7 years later, moments after casting a vote, John Quincy Adams suffered a cerebral hemorrhage and collapsed on the floor of the House of Representatives.
He died 2 days later. The Bible's Book of Luke includes the verse, "To whom much is given, much is required." You may be more familiar with the version in Spider-Man, "With great power comes great responsibility." John Quincy Adams used all that he'd been given in life to serve others until the very end. A Nepo baby done good. Coming up after the break, is she fluffy?
She is definitely a fluffy dog.
Fur babies can be Nepo babies too.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
You ever get that feeling like the concrete jungle's closing in? You crave wide open spaces, the chance to chase your own dinner, or just breathe clean air. Well, listen up. There's a whole world out there waiting, and finding your piece of it just got easier. Head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, you name it. Search by acreage, price, location. They've got it all. No matter what kind of wild dream you're chasing, land.com can help you find the ground to make it a reality. So quit dreaming. Head over to land.com, find your open space, and get out there.
Mr. Khrushchev and I had a very full and frank exchange of views on the major issues that now divide our two countries.
That's President John F. Kennedy in June of 1961, just back from his summit meeting in Vienna with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. It was an especially tense time between the superpowers. The arms race was in full swing, and only months before, Soviet Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space. But in the public relations arena, it was no contest. The Soviets were definitely playing defense against JFK and First Lady Jackie Kennedy. So Khrushchev launched his own charm offensive by sending a glamorous young emissary to the White House. Her name was Pushinka, and she was the daughter of a famous Soviet cosmonaut. When Pushinka arrived on U.S. soil, she was naturally met with suspicion. Could she be a spy? Some wondered if she might be bugged. Legendary White House correspondent Helen Thomas wrote at the time that a dark-eyed, platinum-blonde temptress has invaded the White House. But Pushinka was no spy. She wasn't even human. Pushinka was a small white dog. Her name actually means fluffy in Russian. I first learned about Pushinka back in 2004 when I was writing my thriller about presidential pets and their secret role in presidential decision-making, entitled All the President's Pets. Pushinka was the daughter of the pioneering Soviet space dog, Strelka. In August 1960, Strelka and her co-pilot, Belka, made headlines worldwide as the first two dogs to come back from space alive.
Side note, Laika was the actual first dog in space. In 1957, the Soviets shot her into space without any expectation she'd survive. She didn't. I don't even want to know what the Soviets did to cats. So yes, Pushinka was a Nepo puppy.
She is definitely a fluffy dog.
Alan Price is the director of the John F. Kennedy Library and Museum.
Pushinka is a beautiful dog, absolutely, and a lovely temperament, very friendly dog.
And the Kennedys were very comfortable around dogs. When they moved into the White House the winter before, they brought along Clipper, the German Shepherd, Shannon, the Cocker Spaniel, and Wolf, the Irish Wolfhound. And then there were all their other pets.
They've got Tom Kitten, the cat. They have hamsters named Debbie and Billy. They've got parakeets named Bluebell and Maybell. It's really just incredible.
They had a rabbit named Zsa Zsa, a gift from a magician.
They embrace ponies. They have three of them, right? They've got Macaroni and Tex and Leprechaun.
Funny enough, the president was allergic to both horses and dogs. But it seems he loved dogs more than he hated breaking out. Enter Pushinka, the only dog that came with a passport. Seriously, she actually had a passport. I like to imagine the day Pushinka came to Washington. The other pets lined up inside the White House's grand foyer, awaiting her arrival, wondering who is this mysterious creature they've been hearing about. Suddenly, the front doors open. The sunlight floods in. First a silhouette, then the sound of the dainty padding of feet as the glamorous Pushinka strides in, her nose in the air, taking it all in, but not terribly impressed. The sense of Nepo entitlement would be galling if she weren't so beautiful. Indeed, before long, Pushinka set tongues wagging, none more so than that of Charlie, yet another one of the family's dogs. A roguishly handsome Welsh terrier and favorite of the president's. Soon enough, Charlie and Pushinka were an item.
I believe they were exclusive, though there were certainly other dogs who may or may not have been interested.
Now, Charlie may have had the confidence to put the moves on Pushinka because he too came from privilege. It was said that his uncle was Skippy, the wire fox terrier who famously played Asta in the Thin Man series. So yes, Charlie was a Nepo nephew. It should be noted that Pushinka wasn't just physically attractive.
She's a very smart dog. She learns very quickly from the gardeners that she can climb the ladders on the children's slide. And so they put a peanut on each step to get her to climb higher and higher and then learn to slide down the slide on her own.
The relationship between Charlie and Pushinka progressed quickly. I like to imagine that they did that Lady and the Tramp thing with the string of spaghetti. I assume all dogs who fall in love do that. And in June 1963, Pushinka and Charlie became parents to four adorable pups named Blackie, Butterfly, White Tip, and Streaker. President Kennedy dubbed the offspring Pupniks. 5,000 Americans wrote to the Kennedys pleading to adopt the Pupniks. Two lucky Midwest families were given the honors. To some, the union of Charlie and Pushinka became a symbol of peaceful coexistence, a heartwarming image during a particularly frosty period. But just 5 months later, the meaning attached to the dogs would change.
President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas today. He was shot.
When President Kennedy is assassinated, these pets become a big part of the memories that America holds of a time that ends so abruptly.
Within weeks of the murder of President Kennedy, the family and all their pets vacated the White House. Charlie was sent to live with a Secret Service agent. But what happened to Pushinka?
So you still have Pushinka?
Yes, ma'am.
And how old is she now?
She's going on 4 years old now.
That's the voice of Chief White House Gardener Irvin Williams. He was interviewed in 1965 as part of an oral history for the JFK Library. He recalled that he met with Mrs. Kennedy just 2 days after the president was buried.
And She asked me that time, did I still want Pashinka? And I said, I sure did. And she says, well, Pashinka is yours forever.
They were very close.
This is Irvin Williams's son, Bruce Williams.
She kind of hung out in his office. I have a picture of her under his desk.
Candidly, when I wrote about Pashinka in my book on presidential pets 20 years ago, I never gave much thought to what happened to her after the president's assassination. But after some internet sleuthing, we were able to track down Bruce. We connected on Zoom. He's now in his mid-60s.
I can get the picture and read you the caption.
Bruce showed me a framed photo of the famous White House Rose Garden that his father helped design. Mrs. Kennedy signed the photo.
She says, for Irvin Williams, who made this garden so beautiful for the president, who loved it so much, and it says, who will care for it now that he is gone? And with deep regrets, Jacqueline Kennedy.
So Mrs. Kennedy trusted your father to take care of the Rose Garden.
Yes.
She also trusted him to take care of Pashinka.
Yes, and he was very happy to do that. And that's when she came home to our house.
The Williams family lived in a more modest home in Vienna, Virginia, just outside of Washington. Bruce was just 6 years old, the fourth of five kids.
So one day, just Pashinka shows up in your house.
Yes, my father comes home from work, and Pashinka comes in behind him, and she immediately runs under a chair. And five kids are now eyeballing her, and my brother sticks his hand in, and she nips him. So we all realize that we just need to leave her alone.
But Pashinka soon adjusted to her new suburban life. Often she'd perch on top of the couch, gazing out the window. The Williamses lived on 3 acres, so Pashinka may have very well assumed that this was her country home, or dacha.
And she knew when my father was coming home because she would get up and go to the door. Her tail was really almost like a fan or fluff or something. It was just full of hair and was very cute.
And was she as soft as you wanted her to be?
Oh, yes. But she really wasn't a lap dog. I mean, she liked her belly to be rubbed. And especially when you were outside in the yard, she would like roll over on her back and legs up in the air and you could rub her belly.
In honor of her heritage, Bruce and his siblings photographed Pashinka in a Russian fur cap. And I have to tell you, I love this picture.
That was something we did as kids. So I think that's when we realized that she was a Russian dog.
I mean, in that picture, she really looks like Julie Christie and Dr. Zhivago.
Yes.
You can just hear Laura's theme just playing from that movie there.
I think she was just a little princess. In her own right.
As for this princess's throne?
My father had a little bathroom that he would get ready in the morning, and she found a niche behind the toilet, and that was her home until 1977.
Wow.
That was her happy place.
And though she had receded from the spotlight, Pashinka was still receiving fan mail until the very end. Pashinka died in 1977. She was 16. Bruce's father, Irvin Williams, was devastated.
I was the one who took her to have her put down, and he didn't want to be home when I did that. I mean, she was really bad, but he couldn't bring himself to do that. So I was the one who volunteered to do that. It was sad to do, but she was at peace. That was the important part.
Irvin Williams died in 2018. He was the longest-serving gardener in White House history, serving presidents from Harry Truman through George W. Bush. But he once told a reporter that he would probably be remembered more for his association with Pashinka, and it seems that Irvin Williams was more than fine with that. Pashinka's ashes were sprinkled in his casket. And engraved on the back of Williams' tombstone were the words, with trusted companion, Pashinka.
So she's with him the rest of his life, or eternity, wherever they're going.
Was Pashinka a Nepo baby?
I would have to say yes. I mean, look at the lineage she came from.
But there's oftentimes a bad association with Nepo Baby. Did Pushinka give off the kind of arrogance often associated with Nepo Babies?
I would say no. She was just a dog. I think she just liked to be by herself and away from kids.
And behind the toilet.
And behind the toilet.
I certainly hope you enjoyed this Mobituary. May I ask you to please rate and review our podcast? You can also follow Mobituaries on Facebook and Instagram. And you can follow me on the social media platform formerly known as Twitter at Moraka. Hear all new episodes of Mobituaries every Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Mobituaries Great Lives Worth Reliving, the New York Times best-selling book, now available in paperback and audiobook. It includes plenty of stories not in the podcast. This episode of Mobituaries was produced by Liz Sanchez. Our team of producers also includes Zoe Culkin and me, Moraka, with engineering by Josh Hahn. Our theme music is written by Daniel Hart. Our archival producer is Jamie Benson. Mobituaries production company is Neon Hum Media. Indispensable support from Alan Pang and everyone at CBS News Radio. Special thanks to Steve Razies, Rand Morrison, Wendy Mitros, Amiel Weisvogel, and Alberto Robina. Executive producers for Mobituaries include Megan Marcus, Jonathan Hirsch, and Mo Rocca. The series is created by yours truly.
You ever get that feeling like the concrete jungle's closing in? You crave wide open spaces, the chance to chase your own dinner, or just breathe clean air. Well, listen up. There's a whole world out there waiting, and finding your piece of it just got easier. Head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, you name it. Search by acreage, price, location. They've got it all. No matter what kind of wild dream you're chasing, land.com can help you find the ground to make it a reality. So quit dreaming. Head over to land.com, find your open space, and get out there.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.